We're here for another Double or Nothing. Michael Frazis, how are you going on this beautiful Sydney Friday afternoon?
Hi, Misha. Good. I like the background. That's something new.
Yeah, something fresh. I'm trying new headphones, thanks to the good people at JB Hi-Fi, because the last time I was listening to myself, I sounded awful. So hopefully, yeah, listeners can let us know if I sound better or not. But it feels like it's a huge week. More like we're at the start of something big again. You know, we've been talking about AI quite a bit over the last few months, 6 months, whatever. But you know, with Microsoft and with the kind of weekly kind of developments, it really feels like we're accelerating towards something. What do you think?
Yeah, it's pretty wild, isn't it? I mean, the last week was, it feels like every week something new happens in the space. But the big one was that Google released their tool, which they called Bard, which I didn't really like. I think Bard is a strange name. It's a bit of an ugly word as well.
Do you reckon like Shakespeare, whatever? I don't know.
Bard, but is it like a seer? Is it calling back to like ancient or medieval times? Is it?
Yeah.
Not sure. Maybe it rings well for other people, but doing well for me. And they kind of had a presentation where they released it and just fell very flat. And the stock fell basically 5% 2 days in a row.
It's so hard to know how much skittishness, like how much of it's a perception versus substance. Like yeah. I get the story that Google's scrambling and they're panicked and Microsoft's just going to destroy them. And they can afford for Bing to go to zero as they kind of eat away at Google's core business. Like the thesis is very charismatic and compelling, but it's like, you know, it's a little bit too neat. Like I wonder if they will just develop a really compelling competitor. You know, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a couple of things. So he made it crystal clear, as in Satya Nadella, the Microsoft CEO, that he's going to go after them hard. So he said, like, there is such margin in search, which for us is incremental. For Google, it's not. They have to defend it all, which is true. I mean, Google's got quite a few amazing businesses like Gmail, Android, Google Maps, YouTube, just to think of the ones that roll off the top of the ones that are top of mind. But he's right. They don't need to make money out of this. And Google does. And I think that was more important than a kind of botched release of Bard.
It was one of the most beautiful kind of war cries of a modern CEO, wasn't it? Basically just going, yes, yeah. Oh, we are going for blood and we are going to chop off their head and we're going to put their head on a spike. And it's just like, holy shit. Yeah. It was totally wild.
And it turns out that he, like Satya Nadella, ran Bing before, and he kind of alluded to the point that was like his decision to, obviously it's still his decision as CEO, but to keep Bing as the name, even though it's somewhat tarnished. But the reality is, I think that's quite important that Microsoft's going after it really hard. But the other thing is, like, it's very hard now to see that the revenue model will be anywhere near as good as Google Ads. So even if there's just like some incremental shift away, like already coders, for example, are using ChatGPT and have it open. It's much better for many kinds of searches, but it's not clear that there's that revenue opportunity is there. I mean, Google Ads are just such a perfect product for monetization. And you could also argue they're getting pretty saturated anyway. Like, how much more juice was there in that kind of shift of advertising from traditional to search? I think those are the key concerns. And it's probably not something like, oh, Google's, you know, in serious trouble or going to start losing money even. But it does mean like the growth story is probably not there in the same way.
What does monetization look like here? Because Microsoft kind of buys it a bunch, integrates into its products. Is there any kind of pricing push anywhere, like across its product suite, or is it really just, you know, massively amping up its value proposition and basically eating market share, and you know, consumers get and businesses get all that kind of consumer surplus? At some point, do they kind of just ramp up prices somewhere? Because, you know, like right now, you know, ChatGPT is kind of charging $40 or whatever it is a month in its peak periods. It is delivering like, you know, like 10, 100x value in some cases. You know, businesses, you know, could pay a meaningful amount for that. Do you have a view?
To the extent I have a view, I think it's very hard to advertise here.
Yeah.
I don't think you can really advertise without making it more annoying. And people compare, like, when you ask ChatGPT for an answer and it just gives you a really concise summary, and when you type the same thing into Google and it gives you like 10 ads and 3 BuzzFeed articles and then a Wikipedia article, you know, it's like a material. It's almost like this slow boiling frog, but it's kind of like what Facebook did, where every year they're trying to experiment with ways to cram more ads in, and you kind of don't really notice. It doesn't really affect you, even though the ad load is getting bigger every single year. Until you step away and you go, whoa, like this is just like a page of ads now, and a page of very carefully constructed SEO websites that somehow, for whatever magic reason, they end up being on the front page. So they have kind of, every time they cranked up the dial on monetization and optimized for revenue, there is a pricing in the product or a cost in terms of the quality of the product. And I just think these tools are going to be so competitive that I think the players can be doing Microsoft or try and have a freemium option, but even that's going to be tough. Like I can't remember if I mentioned on the other podcast, I was just chatting with somebody, you know, you can, the Andre Karpathy, the AI, he was head of AI at Tesla. He did a 2-hour tutorial where you can create your own ChatGPT tool. And you can just bash it out. Yeah. I mean, I followed the tutorial, wouldn't pretend to understand it all, but within 2 hours or 2 hours of video, you can actually have your own ChatGPT that runs on your computer that takes in Shakespeare and starts spitting out more Shakespeare.
Yeah. Maybe you know what the answer is. So I understand there's this kind of open source kind of fundamental. Is that just basically free and infinite? Like, can everyone just basically plug into that and ChatGPT just happens public layer that we kind of...
absolutely create your own tools. I wouldn't say it's trivial,
so what did Microsoft
it's very much
buy?
A solved problem. It's very much
so,
a solved problem.
So what did Microsoft actually buy then and plug in if it's kind of free and available anyway?
Well, so you might run a computer with a couple hundred thousand different weights between all the different layers, you know, and then every time you pass through data, it like strengthens or weakens layers depending on how accurate it is. And the number of those parameters that change in ChatGPTs is something like 175 billion. So every time they pass data through, each one of those weights is either strengthened or weakened depending on whether or not it increases or decreases the quality of the output. And really what it does, the crazy thing is, all it does is predict the next word effectively, or the next token, or the next kind of bit that it's going to write, however you choose to define that. That is all it is. It's not like sitting there thinking and then structuring an essay. It's literally going through bit by bit and then using its knowledge of all these different weights. So the challenge is actually is that computational task of putting the whole internet, creating a system with that many parameters. And then putting the whole internet basically through that. That's like a non-trivial task. It's very expensive. So it's more about the data. It's less about like kind of the code, the secret source. It's more about finding a way, like the cost and obviously the expertise to do computing on that scale is very difficult, but that will come down. I reckon I'm sure it already exists already, but you know, a pirate version of this kind of software where people just literally put stuff in. And there's no restrictions whatsoever on the output.
I mean that's something I can see. Use cases are so broad, you know, just to give a few minor ones, you know, in the office here, you know, a lot of people have it open often, and you know, you'll just be able to kind of generate you know, trivial admin tasks like, you know, listing countries, you know, by continent or whatever they were gonna just you're going to do for whatever reason, or you're comparing, you know, a bunch of companies, you know, or shortening descriptions, or even putting in, you know, a paragraph or, you know, extended paragraphs and asking, you know, for bullet points, or put, you know, for it to be tabulated, or, you know, if you have a rubbish kind of podcast transcript that's kind of spat out, that's got poor grammar or spelling or something, you can get it to kind of properly format it. I mean, like, these are kind of trivial examples, but like, you know, how much is global transcription worth today? Like, it's probably not a massive market, but like, it's something meaningful, and that's like an irrelevant kind of footnote market that ChatGPT just absolutely swallows. You know, I reckon it can swallow, you know, going back to my banking years, it can swallow at least, you know, it's worth a bunch of analysts in terms of just kind of formatting stuff and doing so. I mean, surely you're going to have like a format ChatGPT that's kind of optimized towards, you know, formatting things towards, you know, your firm's brand or whatever, or automatically. I mean, this can go, you know, you can quickly see this can go in quite a long way. It's pretty remarkable in terms of productivity enhancement. Like today, and this is like day zero.
It should be trivial for its example to have a corporate version and then input some, you know, certain styles that you like and limits that you do and ways that you want to phrase certain things. And then when somebody at the company kind of puts in their prompts, they get something that's kind of stylized in a certain kind of way, or focus on certain kind of, like that's almost trivial to implement. But going back to Google, like with, because it is so easy to create these, well, not easy, but it's possible, it's a solved problem. It's hard to imagine a version that has ads crawling all over it, like some 19 website from 1996.
It is hard.
You know, it's hard to, like, you just won't want to use that. You won't want to click it.
But that's my thing. Like, I can understand subscription, but like, if Microsoft's just rolling into its suite, it's not even monetizing it directly. So, it's kind of wild. Like, it's not obvious where the monetization comes from. I guess you just got all this value accruing to Microsoft suite and commoditizing the complement. Mm. So basically, it's trying to commoditize everything around it, just make its own existing platforms way more useful without even necessarily charging more. But like, blowing up someone like Google is just is kind of reward in itself.
Yeah, I guess so. And I guess maybe that is reward enough for them to kind of be the dominant player, but it will certainly improve all their products.
Massively.
It's interesting. It seems like it might be interesting. It might be helpful for drug discovery. And I've always been super kind of skeptical along with most people in the industry about AI focused on drug discovery, because actually that's not the bottleneck. The bottleneck isn't promising candidates. It's finding ones that actually work in complex biology that we don't know or understand, but we actually do have a lot of database of drugs that do work and interactions we do know, and that kind of like pattern recognition in ways that we can't predict, it actually does seem kind of suited for.
It seems perfect. I mean, I would have thought the real bottleneck will be regulatory. Like, I mean, I would have thought, why? I mean, I'm curious about, like, you know, new minerals or metallurgies that we haven't considered, you know, just purely based on past discoveries. I would have thought, like, just intuitively, I would have thought, you know, our level of discovery based on existing data sets would be quite limited, and we, you know, and that just kind of running through historic data, we should be able to find stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know in the past, like, chemical space is just vastly more broad than people who aren't in the industry kind of appreciate. You've just got so many, like, it really is vast. Like, once you get beyond like 10 molecules, it's very difficult to calculate certain things. But I do wonder, like, I wonder if that's changed in even the last few years. as these things get bigger and better. So you think about those. I mean, it helped in mathematics, right? So one of the big discoveries that we actually talked about in the pod was when they found a new way of doing matrix multiplication, which actually speeds up AI, because multiplying matrices is the core part of AI, the core computational difficult bit. And the trick is you want to try and do as many addition steps and as few multiplication steps as possible, because addition is just much, 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 much faster. And it found a new algorithm for doing multiplying matrices of a certain size that hadn't been discovered yet. So it already has found an algorithm that is not only unique and original, but also improves itself. And so you're kind of getting to that holy grail of an AI that improves itself. You're already seeing steps taken in that direction. It's pretty phenomenal. And then in terms of like an investment perspective, it's been interesting to see, our view is semiconductors. And so far, it seems like that has broadly played out already. Got to be careful here, because I remember, when was the last hype cycle? I mean, there's been a few over the years, but the last one that like really fizzled was probably the metaverse, where there was a moment where like Roblox and all those stocks just kind of absolutely ripped, and then promptly dropped 70-80%. I don't think it's the same with these companies though.
What is your view on the whole metaverse? I mean, like, I just, you know, this whole AI thing, I think, has only accelerated the case for it. And frankly, I don't know, maybe there's a universe, I'm speaking kind of out of ignorance, but there's a universe where Meta kind of stands up and goes, actually, we've spent a ton of money on this, and here's a rabbit out of the hat. Because, you know, you kind of see on Twitter or elsewhere, you've got these kind of, you know, hyper-realistic human AI-generated images. And, like, you can quickly see that, you know, descending into like hyper real, porn is kind of like the obvious thing, like, you know, a third of the internet is porn or whatever. So like a third of presumably AI generated stuff, you know, will kind of follow the same kind of thing. But obviously it's really about, you know, how to make that experience immersive and not just porn, but kind of any kind of hyper realistic VR experience. And you know, for that you need kind of new hardware, which, you know, Meta's really trying to build. They've got obviously Oculus and the like. I can totally see Zuck being, you know, I think Zuck is basically kind of almost obviously directionally right over like a, I don't know, 10, 20 year view, who knows how long these kind of timelines last for. Who knows if he successfully executes and whether they've kind of got the right product and the right kind of tech or how that plays out. I don't pretend to have any kind of special insights here. But it feels like, you know, AI is only an accelerant for the kind of metaverse, thesis over the kind of medium term. What do you reckon?
Metaverse is hard. I think I'm sure it will be a hugely valuable platform, but
not Meta specifically, but like the whole idea of this kind of immersive VR thing, surely like that's still coming, and surely AI
will come, yeah.
Accelerant.
I don't know if it will be in the form that people expect. I think if anything there's gonna be a pushback in the other direction. I think there might even end up being more of a premium on certain kinds of art that are done by hand and are not like real experiences.
Yeah.
I can imagine that becoming the luxury kind of thing. Like maybe it's the skill of a well-drawn or well-painted painting becomes much more interesting. And instead of abstract art, art moves in a different direction. It goes back to the point we actually need somebody who's skilled to do it. I'm just riffing here.
Sure.
But it wouldn't surprise me if it goes in that, because now the other stuff is just not as impressive anymore. Like digital art, like somebody who writes the right prompts can create digital art, you know, beyond anybody's imagination previously. And I mean that, like literally stuff that nobody would have thought about, not a single person has thought about. But there's still only one way to like draw something very well, and that's to be very good at it and have done it.
But so what else is exciting you in markets?
I'm not sure. Look, I think there's been a huge run in assets in the last kind of 6 to 8 weeks. I think the market's kind of digesting that now. I think I do wonder, like, there was another rate rise when it was clear inflation was falling. And even though the Fed kind of acknowledged that, I do wonder if at some point there's going to be one of these rate rises that might just be one too many. You know, inflation's falling. Powell's talked about disinflation twice now. He's finally seeing what everybody else is seeing. But they're still pumping through these rate rises, even though they know that there's a huge lag, like potentially a 6 to 12 month lag on rate rises. So all the disinflation that he's talking about has come before even taking the account. So that's kind of like a bit of a risk. And then I think there's going to be a huge disparity between really high quality companies with earnings and the ones that are not. I mean, that sounds obvious, but you know, there's been decade long periods where fast growing companies outperform. And there's periods where they don't, and we're kind of the back end of one of those. But again, like I look at the growing semiconductor companies, which are growing at the same rate as fast growing software. Some of them anyway, but with profits much easier. They just seem to be trading so much better, than software companies that it might be down 70-80%, but, still haven't got those metrics. And it feels like the cost cutting, it feels like there's more of this cost cutting to come. You know, Salesforce, all these big companies are like doing big rounds of layoffs, but they all kind of service each other, right? So every time you hear of like this company laid off 3,000 people, that's like could be 3,000 Salesforce licenses, 3,000 Teams licenses, you know, probably 30 or 40 different SaaS company licenses. Just go. And there will be a point when that kind of reverses and it stops being contracting and there's like net adding of seats. But at the moment in tech, it's still, we're still going through that process now. You know, it will be over. I reckon it will be over this year. I think this is the year that companies make it or they don't on the smaller scale. And, you know, imagine if you're a software engineer and you got kind of laid off now, you'll just go straight into one of these AI startups that are madly hiring. Or you'd be able to create using, you know, the APIs of these AI tools that are now available, you could create all kinds of different products on top of that. I bet you, like, if a good software engineer that got laid off now, it's probably end up looking back and thinking one of those moments where that thing that was so bad actually ends up being, you know, one of the best things that happens to you.
And what do you think of, Microsoft, the stock, out of interest? Long?
Look, it's a beast. I mean, it's hard.
It's $2 trillion now. It's going to be the first $5 trillion business.
Yeah, I don't know, but I think there's some companies just bill everybody, you know? It's Microsoft bills every business. So every business has a seat, a Microsoft seat, and the products are so good and so intrinsically important. And they are finding new ways to add value, and adding these AI tools to them will just be more. Like, I think it's very hard to go past. It's not super cheap stock, but it's not super cheap, super expensive either. I think it's 10 to 15% growth still for the mid to long term is reasonable. They can just raise prices. You know, it's a pricing thing as well. The more value they add as well, especially with these tools, they're going to be able to do it. And it's just relentless. I mean, it's like even Google, like they've been doing this to all kinds of startups, just copying products. Teams, obviously the one that comes to mind, taking on Slack and Zoom. But, you know, now they're even going to try and really go for Google. Like it's just a monster of a company, constantly improving its services, generating huge amounts of money, huge amounts of investment. I think on the risk reward, I mean, I always said this thing, we're not going to buy big tech, which ultimately I'd say looking back on the last 5 years was an error. And the reason it was an error is because we had three consecutive sell-offs, like 2018, 2020, and 2022 to now. And no doubt, you know, every few years there'll be a sell-off. Whenever that happens, there's a huge flow into tech and a huge flow out of anything smaller. And because we're always in the smaller, faster growing companies, we always lose more of the market. It was just very annoying. And meanwhile, these companies just like ground up year after year after year. But of those, I think it's very hard to go past Microsoft. I think Google is out for now in terms of big tech. I think that there's enough of a reason to think that the incremental growth is going to go elsewhere, that it's probably not the best. It's not going to go under. It's not going to go anywhere. It's not even going to lose money. But, you know, there's that incremental search, that incremental attention. They're probably going to lose. And so that means it's going somewhere else. So...
speaking of attention, did you see the other day, this is kind of wild, chess.com was the number one app in the App Store, like full stop. So like we live in an era of like Roblox and like whatever people play, and StarCraft and whatever. I don't even know what people are playing these days. Mm-hmm. And like good old sturdy hundreds-year-old or thousands-year, I don't know how old chess is, you know, is like crushing on the top, because we've spoken a little bit about that. And I just
even though it's solved, basically solved the game.
AI solved it, right? So you can play against computers at whatever rating, but like your experience as a chess player is like obviously not solved. And so that's kind of like an interesting kind of what's old is new again. I think you'll see a lot of that.
I think that's going to be a trend.
I totally agree. I
played again after our conversation, and literally exactly what we talked about. Like I'd obviously got to some higher rating, obviously still very low, but some higher rating that, because I hadn't played in 6 months, I was just not up for, and I lost a very frustrating game. And I was
It drives me nuts. I have to play less
reminds me of surfing. Whereas like surfing, people from the outside looks like it's amazing, it's glorious, it's relaxing, and it is all those things.
Freaking slog.
So frustrating. You're always missing waves, you're always getting smashed, you're always trying something that doesn't
work. You're always making a mistake.
Honestly, the whole time you're kind of frustrated.
I totally agree. You're like, oh, it's meditative and serene. No, you're like battling white water, you're getting smashed, you miss a good wave, you fumble, you know, you miss time it. I totally agree.
Yeah. But I noticed that you wrote a pretty interesting long form piece on Kvetch. Am I saying Kvetch right?
You're saying Kvetch very right. So reminder to listeners, K V E T C H, Kvetch. Is that wait, how I said that? Yeah, that's right. Which basically means like whinge or complain in Yiddish. So, I mean, I basically, you know, as you know, I basically just, you know, listen to audiobooks, whatever, and then I kind of turn those into notes. And sometimes those notes turn into, you know, a piece just by virtue of, you know, me being very overly excited by it. And so I took a break from Master of the Senate, which is volume 3 of The Years of Lyndon Johnson by Robert Caro, which is like unbelievable and excellent. And we should actually talk about that. And we'll actually take a break to talk about that. So this morning I was into Master of the Senate and I noticed, you know, there are
Master of the Senate.
It's called Master, which is volume 3 of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, the biography. And it's super interesting because the way Lyndon Johnson, so he's kind of famous in this kind of episode that I'm reading about for kind of taking control of the uncontrollable, unmanageable Senate, US Senate. And the way he does it is actually very similar to the way that people control board meetings. You know, decisions are made outside of the room ahead of time. Each kind of stakeholder is kind of consulted and you know, and worked with, and their interests are aligned. And actually within the board meetings, there shouldn't be a debate or discussion. That's all kind of happened outside. It's all been kind of solved outside. So it should be quite efficient and process based. And so you can actually interestingly see, you know, today Lyndon Johnson would have been, his grandfather was a soldier. You can see him being a very successful kind of senior military person, but you can kind of see him being a founder, assembling teams and striving for excellence. Or, it's interesting to reflect on the kind of context he would have been successful in. And that time, you know, politics, and the U.S. Government was a kind of more vibrant and powerful place. And it's interesting just to kind of compare his style of managing power with how investors and executives kind of need to wield and manage power as well. So that's a quick aside, but I took a break from that and I kind of read Conquistadors, a new book by Fernando Cervantes, which came out a couple of years ago. And it's basically the most detailed really wonderful overview of the Spanish conquests of the New World. So Columbus, Cortes, who kind of defeated the Mexica in what's now Mexico, the Aztecs, and then Pizarro, who defeated the Inca in Peru, and then a few others. And the striking thing is that these like are plausibly the greatest feats of kind of heroic endeavor and adventure ever. Basically ever. You know, here we literally have sometimes dozens, up to hundreds of men taking on empires, vicious military warrior empires, bloodthirsty empires of, millions of inhabitants and tens or hundreds of thousands of, soldiers, and defeating them. It's something out of Homer epic. Like they're not really modern. They're from 1490 to 1550. 500 years ago. But these are the closest real life examples of Odysseus and Achilles that we have. And their stories are just shocking, like in terms of what they had to endure, the way they were able to pick up allies on the way and connive and sometimes resort to sheer force. Their horses and their gunpowder and the artillery and their swords and their armor were obvious advantages, but still, they wouldn't have got very far. In fact, they would have gone nowhere without kind of allies and kidnapping the emperors and holding them at ransom and a lot of the detail is just totally wild. So there's no grand lesson here, just out of, there are kind of, there are infinite lessons here about, how peoples interact and the like, but just out of sheer titillation, these are remarkable, remarkable stories.
Yeah, and I mean, I think what came across in the note that you wrote was just like, it really was a human experience that people lived. Like, imagine riding with Cortez and just being there in that city for the first time.
I'm glad that came across. Like, I mean, these should not be, and I didn't quite, I mean, I've read probably half a dozen books on the subject now, but like, you know, before that, I didn't quite appreciate, I assume they kind of went there and there were these kind of backward barbarian, like, you know, like Stone Age. No. So, you know, Cortez with his men, as they entered Tenochtitlan, the capital of the Mexica city.
Where is that? Is that where Mexico City is? Or is it somewhere different?
I think it's somewhere different. I'm gonna sound really dumb here. I don't quite recall. Let's have a look.
Now historic center of Mexico City.
Okay, awesome. So it is Mexico City. I thought so, but then I didn't want to sound like an idiot. So now I sound like an idiot anyway. So these men had seen Rome. They'd seen Constantinople. They're Spanish men. So they've seen the great cities of Spain at the time, and Tenochtitlan was the greatest city in the world at the time. You know, it basically was, it kind of was built in the center of this enormous lake and had these, canals kind of running through and these golden spires. You know, like this is a magic city kind of our dreams. They ultimately destroyed the whole thing because it was kind of, very well set up for defense. And so as they were kind of, it's obviously a long story and you can kind of read the detail, but as they were kind of attacking, they had to kind of go street by street and they couldn't kind of go through, preserve it without basically dying. So unfortunately, and even they write with great pity how much pity it was that they had to raise it, but they ultimately raised this great global city. And you have to remember, the Aztec, they didn't have wheels. You know, they didn't invent the wheel yet, okay? And there was good reason because it was kind of like stony terrain and it was mountainous, and so it wasn't quite as useful. But they also didn't have domesticated animals. So they didn't have, they saw horses for the first time when the Spanish brought them. You know, they didn't have oxen. They had llamas, but they weren't quite, as useful. The Aztecs kind of saw horses for the first time and men atop them in armor shining steel. Like, it is of course you kind of think, who are these demons or these what are these great men? And for them to have built these great cities, you know, with pretty advanced technology and these enormous gardens and the like, without the wheel and without kind of domesticated animals, I mean, the whole thing, it's kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, and I guess there's the other part, the other side of that whole culture is how violent it is. Now, of course, the medieval ages were pretty violent as well.
You're absolutely right.
All kinds of burnings and flaying alives and...
You're exactly right. And you're right. So Europe was like, this was around the time of the sacking of Rome. And like, there's just, it was an enormously violent time throughout Europe. And as you said, you've got like, decapitations and, burnings in Europe, and Europe's not exactly kind of pretty, but the Aztecs and the kind of the various peoples across the New World, they certainly had their share of violence, and it was quite inculcated into their religion. They had gods who were called the flaying gods, and they'd flay their victims and wear their skins during festival or sacrifice children, and they had kind of these enormous wars where the whole purpose was just to exchange prisoners to kind of feed their gods, these sacrificial victims. So it was a brutal and savage, and the Spaniards hated it. Like the first time, there's a story of the Aztec emperor trying to honor his guests, he kind of sacrificed his victims and sprinkled their heart, the blood from the heart onto their food. And the Spaniards were like, what the F? This is horrendous. And basically, were totally disgusted. And again, Europeans had their own kind of complexes. And there's some interesting overlap, as well as kind of conflict like this. And look, obviously in my piece, I kind of focused on kind of those parts just because they're like freaking cool and awesome. but they're kind of the highlights, but it's just reading about it. It's just totally wild.
Yeah. I remember when I was in Mexico City, they have this huge stone in one of the museums, in the main museum, where they used to like sacrifice people. And that is a spooky thing.
Yeah.
Stone where people stretch across. It's enormous. It's heavy. It's carved with all stuff. It's covered channels of blood.
Yeah. So they've got whole catacombs, I think they're called, beneath Mexico, where they're just lined with skulls. It's horrendous. I mean, and it's not just them. I mean, there's a part two coming out, and you'll see in the next part. The Spaniards certainly had their share of brutality. One guy was like so famously horrendous to the native population in Peru, like Charles V, the Emperor of Spain and the Holy Roman Empire. He basically compensated the locals for the brutality of this guy. His worst deed was probably just murdering 600 children. Like he's that's not typical, and the Spanish crown and the church were pretty against bad treatment of natives and enslavement of them and the like, and that still happened. There was kind of a disconnect between what happened on the ground versus what Spain kind of said, and so there's a whole bunch of bad stuff that the Spaniards did, like obviously, but the kind of the day to day kind of violence enmeshed into the Inca and the Aztec cultures was certainly there.
So so after all that reading, what is Cortez like? Is he an evil man or is he?
I don't think so. I definitely stand on the side of admiration. These people, some of them did bad things, like Pizarro in the next part you'll see. You can always argue in the margins they were needlessly brutal on occasion in putting down violence or whatever, and that's a fair criticism, whatever. But ultimately, these people didn't go killing, they didn't just genocide the local. It was really about what happened was they ultimately took over these empires. One reason they succeeded was they effectively decapitated a hyper-centralized empire and replaced it with a new Spanish elite. And frankly, the next 300 years in the Spanish New World were very peaceful. There wasn't a standing army. There wasn't really a police force. You couldn't really police this indigenous population when there were like 5,000 to 1 Spaniards versus indigenous. So by its nature, it was very peaceful, and they just successfully managed the local power centers. And so you really, the right comparison in my view is like, which elite, are we supportive of like the Inca emperor, who had just, he had just defeated his brother in a dynastic feud and basically publicly made his brother watch the slaughter of his wife and children in a sadistic way in front of him as punishment, or like flayed, his lieutenants and wore their skins. Like, do we really sympathize with that elite? Are those the good guys? Like, no, the Spaniards were better than that. And they were there not for selfless reasons, largely. I mean, there were some, like the Christian missionaries and some of the Spanish crown wanted those subjects to basically be, well-treated subjects and to kind of build a fine civilization. But ultimately, these conquistadors were deeply selfish. They were there for glory, for treasure, for women, all that kind of stuff, 100%. So they're not like altruistic or anything. But like, it's very difficult to feel sympathetic to the incumbent elites in that land. And sure, they were replaced by the Spaniards, and then there was pretty peaceful kind of rule.
Should we wrap up there then?
Yeah, let's wrap up there. So that was fun. And let's see what happens next week.